Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It Home Edition.
I remain in my closet, and I have to tell you something. I just realized it now. Every time I get into this closet to record, In the Closet by Michael Jackson plays in my head. Every time.
I too. Lewis, I've taken your note. I have transitioned to my closet as well because the acoustics are just better and I feel isolated in the way I want to be. But I'm uncomfortable. And once again, the irony is not lost on me that I am in the closet on this gay podcast.
No, it's like a bad short story with a bad metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is with your homes? Can you like put some things in them, some things on the wall so that the acoustics, I don't know, get better?
Padded. I like to refer to it as a bunker.
Your home shouldn't be this airy.
Mine's a hardwood floor situation. That's the issue.
It's a minimalist. That's a loft.
The Love It or Leave It are called the Love It or Leave It back in the closet because I guess he's recording in his closet.
Well, John Lovett came out, 10 minutes ago? So that metaphor is brand new to him. I'm kidding.
That's fair. He's never been to a discotheque.
He and Ronan, by the way, I feel like I keep hearing updates about their relationship or how their domestic situation is every second. They're like Tori and Dean all of a sudden. I can't stop hearing about them.
Howie Mandel and Terry Hatcher. Anyway, we have a very fun show today. We will be talking to Daveed Diggs.
Woo!
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Aida. Did you not say Keep It a couple of weeks ago to Snowpiercer, the TV series? And look at us now, confronted with Daveed.
Look at Lewis bringing receipts to the reunion.
Long ones. CBS
texting
ones.
Andy Cohen. Look,
this might be the theme of Keep It, is that every Aida Keep It will be taken back in 3 or 4 episodes. Just keep that in the back of your mind. I did it with Dave. I'm doing it with Snowpiercer. And who knows? I might do it with today's Keep It, too.
You know, so it's a lie, but she promises to lie. Just know
I
that.
Promise. So consistency is what I can promise you, too.
That's right. Which reminds me, Ira, I was talking about this with Aida earlier. Have we ever had a Tony winner on this show before? I don't think so.
Not while I've been around, for sure.
Besides me, of course. You remember my turn in the glass menagerie. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I've had a couple nominations.
But it never pans out for you.
Yes, you know what? But those are all producing nominations. And Lewis and I only stand competitive Tony winners.
That's right, yeah. We actually have a couple of friends who've won producing Tony nominations, the New Oklahoma, etc. And I'm not saying they're not accomplished people. It is not the same thing. Mm-hmm. You're not in the split screen on primetime, so it doesn't mean anything.
Okay, it means you ran someone their money.
Precisely, yeah.
And if I had the money to cut a check, I would be producing Shrek 2 on Broadway. Shrek the Shreksicle.
Yikes.
Wait, no, Shrek 3, Shrek Wrecked, or whatever those chipmunk movies are.
And we will also be talking about commencement speeches, digital graduations, and offering some of our own advice to the class of 2020.
Should be really helpful. You guys are gonna grow so much after this one.
You poor kids. You poor kids.
Anyway, we'll be right back. Well, the president is ingesting hydroxychloroquine, and I'm on my second bottle of wine this morning.
You're the same. The two of you are the same. Is it working?
This is stand-up.
At least is the wine working for you?
Yeah, you know, it's killing something in me.
Because I don't know if Trump can say that about the hydroxychloroquine for him.
Mm. It's not killing enough of you, as far as I'm concerned, Ira, but you'll get there.
But speaking of consuming things, look at that segue.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
Edward R. Murrow in charge of the news here. Wow.
What have we all consumed this week in the culture?
I did a brand new thing, which was consuming old stuff that is arguably forgotten. So
that you've never done, yes.
Isn't that really
never
strange?
Never done that
new.
Before.
This is so new
never,
for Lewis.
Never experienced any of that before.
I love giving you this novelty, yes.
What year this time?
We're going to start in 1983. What's happening then? Thriller is out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just bringing up Michael Jackson again and again. I'm sorry. But also...
The Mary Jane Girls.
Oh, my... Actually, let's just do a whole episode on the Mary Jane Girls. I could listen to them all day.
I was listening to their 83 album all last week. It was my writing soundtrack.
Is that All Night Long? Does that have that on it?
Yeah.
Okay. So, in the wake of E.T., which came out the previous year, which is, you know, a gigantic sci-fi movie... that has small nuclear family elements in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's this movie called Testament, starring Jane Alexander, Best Actress nominee, which is a movie about the nuclear apocalypse happening, and there are no special effects in the movie. It's just about how people in a small town deal with it in a mundane way before they are all wiped out.
Mm.
And I've got to tell you, it is one of the perfect quarantine movies to watch. If you've never heard of it, it is literally a woman finding out via the news that there's a nuclear apocalypse. A newscaster says this is real. And then her family members, like her kids, start getting sick. Her husband doesn't come home. She has to sort of mingle with the neighbors a little bit. It is so small. And there are certain COVID parallels in that, for instance, she'll be in line at the grocery store and then somebody will accuse her of cutting, and then there's a hostility between everyone because they know, you know, it's such a fraught time. So there, mm-hmm. there's that weird element. But also, her performance is so great. It's such an underrated movie, and I'm surprised it's not a classic because the best parts of it, the family discussions, remind me of my favorite parts of E.T., which are those small family moments.
That feels a little Twilight Zone.
Yes.
A little Monsters on Maple Street.
Mm-hmm.
I'm irritated by how confrontational you are with the, like, pandemic psychology right now. How are you doing
that?
You're
right.
Very avoidant about that stuff. But, I mean, I guess that's, like, that's a new take on it.
Yeah. I couldn't watch any of that. Like, people watching Contagion, couldn't do that. I saw the other day... that Bug was available, that Tracy Letts play that was turned into a film. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that literally seems like my skin would start crawling itself.
But I will say, sounds interesting, Lewis. I will give this a look because it's, like you said, a whole other angle.
And also, by the way, it's like 86 minutes long or something. So
Okay. Exactly
in our wheelhouse of tolerability. Additionally.
Rebecca De Mornay's in it. You didn't tell me that.
and so is Kevin Costner in one of his first roles. Yeah. Additionally, I, for some reason, this is going to make me seem like a total poser when it comes to prestige movies, have avoided the latter two Richard Linklater Before movies. These are the movies that are Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. They're essentially movies about two people, and it's a romance, like it, but it's two people having a conversation, basically in three different movies. I had underestimated the power of everybody involved in these movies. This is another quarantine essential as far as I'm concerned because it reminds you of the excitement of talking to another person, of getting you excited to just have one-on-one interaction, you know? And I mean, like, I'm at a loss for words when talking about this. The reason I watched these, in fact, was because last week Ira brought up Collateral,
mm-hmm.
and that made me think about Ethan Hawke. Guys, so he was snubbed for First Reformed last year, and... it's crazy that both of these actors were not nominated for all three of these movies. Let me tell you something. It's just a conversation. It is never once contrived. There's never once a moment of dialogue that is written to indicate who the characters are. Like, oh, here's my quirky characteristic. Here's my weird side. They're just people who genuinely seem to want to connect with other people using all of their intelligence and all of their empathy. And it's a movie series that puts you in a place of calm and concentration.
Mm-hmm.
unlike almost anything else I've seen, and I truly recommend it for everybody. I think that it's a fabulous trilogy, maybe my favorite trilogy.
You know how I feel like Ethan Hawke should have won for Boyhood 2 in 2015. I think I've made that clear as well. I love that man. Mm. And it's not just that that story is about Nebraska. It's just I like love him so much. So I'm with you. I'll watch it. I will give it a look. I told you that I would, and I'll report back next week with my opinions.
It's also, by the way, so strange that Patricia Arquette won for Boyhood, and Julie Delpy has not been nominated for acting once. This woman will react sometimes a dozen times to something Ethan Hawke has said within the space of 30 seconds, and it's never once put on. I never once think, oh, that was false, etc. And the camera is constantly on her, too. It's an amazing performance.
Yeah, she should win awards for her bone structure alone. Please. That woman is one of the most unique-looking women I've ever seen. Mm.
Though you know I love a French actress, Julie Delpy.
Every fucking week.
J'adore Julie Delpy. Catherine Deneuve is shook.
it's been a while but, since Catherine's come up.
You know, Ira, dare I say you're improving. Dare I say that. I really
merci. Yeah. Merci beaucoup. I love a romantic drama. Mm-hmm. And I agree with Lewis that as a writer, those films are beautiful to just sort of watch because they do teach you economy of dialogue, you know? Yeah. I started Masterclass recently, uh-huh. Fun, like you did, and I was looking at Aaron Sorkin's one.
How's that?
It's fine. It's fun. I'm in such a weird quarantine headspace where I feel like I need just some sort of brain refresher on writing in general because mm-hmm. I feel like I don't want to do it. Unless I'm doing it for work. But, you know, just the idea of, like, writing shouldn't be about, like, showing off your tricks. You know, it should be about two characters interacting. And I think that in the before movies, they are just interacting with one another and they feel so human. I didn't love Boyhood that much, but mm-hmm. I do love a Linklater film. I'm one of the few stans of Everybody Wants Some.
I am too. I honestly think that movie is excellent.
It is gay porn.
That also.
Basically.
Yeah.
The hottest men just in this movie, all in baseball uniforms, all in 80s shorts. But that's another movie, right? That just feels like his movies feel so human and lived in, which was why Where'd You Go, Bernadette was so odd.
No, that's the craziest addition to his catalog. Also, another weird thing about these movies is, so it's just two people talking the entire time. And of course, if you don't know the lore, they were filmed 9 years apart. So one's in 1995, mm-hmm. one's in 2004.
Later. Yeah. Record later.
Yes, precisely. Nobody makes a single pop culture reference the entire time, and I have to tell you, that's my entire identity.
Oh.
And some of the scenes are built out of the actor's improvisation that are then worked into the script, but mm-hmm. otherwise, it just seems impossible to comprehend that they could get these movies together. It really does seem crazy to me.
It does seem odd to watch a movie that doesn't make pop culture references, and I sometimes do err on the side of, should you be making, like, current pop culture references in writing? Because, for instance, like a 30 Rock.
Right.
Yeah.
As much as it's so fucking funny, feels very dated now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how anyone younger could watch it and understand it. But also, Shakespeare plays are full of pop culture references, right? Mm-hmm. They just don't make sense to us anymore.
Right, right.
I think when it comes to pop culture references, I get tired of it as a device when they're trying to like hammer down what decade it's in. Like they're trying to use it as like a time travel device. Mm-hmm. That's when I start to get irritated, when I start to notice it.
And reference jokes, right?
Oh,
you know,
my
like
God.
if you're just talking to someone and you're like, shut up, Eddie Haskell.
Like that's not a roast.
That's not a joke.
That's not a roast.
Also, R.I.P. Eddie Haskell.
I know, he just died. I was wondering if that's why you thought of it. Yeah,
yeah, it is why I thought of it. It's so weird me thinking of me like this black kid in the Midwest watching Leave It to Beaver.
Right.
But I was obsessed with Nick at Night TV Land, so I watched Leave It to Beaver every night it was on.
Oh, sure. Also, Eddie Haskell, if people don't know, so that's a character in Leave It to Beaver, and he is this unctuous neighbor who like is always in Beaver's mom's good graces, but he's, you know, a little shit. We don't have another name for that. It's like when the term douchebag hit popular culture. We don't have a synonym for that, so I have to keep saying that horrible word.
Yeah, but Eddie Haskell is weirdly such an enduring piece of pop culture. Like, you can have references to Eddie Haskell going into movies now, you know? And
right.
I think that people would understand what you mean, even if they've never seen Leave It to Beaver.
Meanwhile, Barbara Billingsley, the mom on that show, her only other lasting pop culture legacy is that she speaks jive in Airplane, which should last us a long time.
A very funny scene.
Great scene. Great scene.
Aida, what have you watched?
Well, I feel like I can't not mention the Nelly versus Ludacris versus. I don't know if you guys watched it.
I had my FUBU on. You saw my FUBU jersey.
Slick down.
Yes, I got some vintage FUBU. Yeah. Finally, I've wanted to get vintage FUBU since Solange dropped the song FUBU on A Seat at the Table. And I finally got some this week off Poshmark.
How was it? Look, I have like an old yellow like windbreaker that I like to wear. My FUBU just makes, and a tall tee. I just like to be ignorant in my FUBU.
It's great. And I remembered, thankfully, sizing from the mid to early 2000s in that the sizes were much bigger than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And so like I went a size down from what I normally have and it fit me perfectly.
Yes.
Because like wearing just like an XL in like 2002 was like a double triple XL.
Yeah, Ira, do you not want the hem of your shirt to touch your ankles? Like, what's wrong with you?
So if you wore baggy FUBU gear, would you still be wearing bootcut jeans with that or no?
I think that you would. And then like some like really disgusting Buffalino shoes, like thick shoes that have nothing to do with the outfit that you're wearing.
Okay.
But also part of it is a lot of FUBU gear can go with Tim's.
Mm-hmm.
And
Tim's.
The ankles of your pants are just sort of tucked into your boots at that point.
So can't tell. It's irrelevant then. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, so the Nelly versus Ludacris was very entertaining when Nelly could get his Wi-Fi to work. Ira, you were live tweeting it and it was very, very fun. A lot of people were live tweeting it and it was just giving me that communal feeling again that we get during like award shows and live TV commentating. Like I think Versus is the only pandemic programming that like all of us have gotten behind, at least barely, or at least to mock it. So I really do appreciate that Versus is staying consistent. Luda had hits for days.
Mm-hmm.
Nelly's Wi-Fi was shorting out, but like even pixelated Nelly is sexy as fuck. Like 8-bit Nelly adapted for Atari was still like chef's kiss.
Yeah, it was a reminder that Luda has so many hits. Hits, but also jams.
Yes.
You know? I think Nelly has hits, but Ludacris has, like, jams that I want to vibe to.
Mm-hmm. Did Gossip Folks come up?
He didn't play Gossip Folks, but he did play Minuteman.
Oh, hell yes. Okay, good for us. Good for you guys.
Yeah, with a shout out to Missy.
Mm-hmm.
One, I do love the community of it because it feels very much like Black folks are just getting together and still live tweeting and finding ways to connect on Twitter throughout this, and it's happening every week. Unfortunately, there was a moment where Nelly's Wi-Fi wasn't working and Luda was playing like that unreleased song of his.
Yuck.
That line where it was like, I still love R. Kelly. And it was like, what?
Yeah.
And then ran it back.
Yeah, he played it like three times. And then the lyric after that is like, I love R. Kelly. I just won't let him around my daughters. Like something around that.
Yeah.
He like still acknowledges the abuse, but is cool with it. Like, yeah, it was very disgusting. It was a disgusting moment. And also it was kind of entertaining watching Ludacris have an anxiety attack because you can see he's not comfortable handling any situation other than like, you know, making music and rapping, and just didn't have the wherewithal to be like, I'm going to entertain on live while Nelly figures out his internet. And Nelly was like, it's raining in St. Louis. It's raining over here. So that's why my Wi-Fi is bad. Like, nigga, what?
And unfortunately, there from 2017, there are also some BuzzFeed reports of multiple rape allegations against Nelly. So
I expect more out of people who make Vanna White references in rap.
Things we didn't know. Really? Yeah.
Grim.
So yeah, that I watched that. Of course, Sunday gave us the like wrap up of The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary. So I watched that, and by far, episode 9 was the funniest shit I've ever seen in my life because Michael Jordan tries to tell everyone that during one of his games against Utah, right before he was really sick, he was poisoned by a Utah pizza place, a local pizza place, and that they were all out to get him, and they sent 4 or 5 men to his hotel room, and they gave him a pizza that made him sick. So that's a little bit of his insight. Might be some revisionist history, might be some propaganda. I don't know. I have opinions. Nobody's willing to entertain me on them, though.
I want that draw room murder mystery, though, right? Like Michael Jordan as a detective trying to figure out who was murdered by a poison pizza.
Yes.
And he gathers everyone on the basketball court and does like the whole, and you, but the killer was you.
Now, did I hear this correctly that they never bring up his time with the Washington Wizards?
They don't.
Yeah, so I was going to bring up the fact that I really love The Last Dance, but I do also agree with Ken Burns that it's not proper journalism.
100%.
Ken Burns isn't British. I don't know why I said that, but he did say proper journalism, I believe, just because... I discussed when we first talked about Last Dance, right? You know, that the whole sort of contract was that it could be released, all that footage, when Michael Jordan agreed to it. And he's listed as a producer. So, unfortunately, it's not going to get into the nitty-gritty of Michael, you know? Just because, like, he's a producer and he could sanitize some of it. And, yeah, it mentions his golf. But the, literally pretends like his time at the Wizards did not happen.
Right, exactly. And then also the story around like Isaiah Thomas and the 1992 Olympic team, like it makes it out to be that they didn't tiff the way that they did and that, you know, Michael Jordan wasn't an antagonist in the way that he was. So, you know, like you said, you know, when they're, when he's
the gambling too.
Yeah.
The gambling stuff was very sanitized.
It was all a lot. But that, at the end of the day, I still really enjoyed the documentary. I thought it was really good. I think it might get nominated for an Oscar, but I don't think it was as good as other sports documentaries that we've gotten. So, mostly the OJ one, but that's a special case.
Well, speaking of romantic dramas that Lewis was talking about before, I dipped into the romantic side of Scorsese this week.
Oh, which one?
Yeah, well, so I watched Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore for the first time.
Which is a very crazy character for Ellen Burstyn. Great performance.
It's fantastic. And I think that Roger Ebert actually praised it a lot because it gave Ellen a role to sort of live in as opposed to, you know, the way she was in like The Exorcist Last Picture Show, right?
Correct, yep.
She's so great in it. And Kris Kristofferson's in it. He's fantastic. I think of him as like a BG for straight people.
Totally.
And Harvey Keitel's in it. And that man is fine.
I know. People forget like...
In his 20s in that film, he is hot. It makes sense that like Whoopi's character was with him in the beginning of Sister Act as opposed to what we think Harvey Keitel looks like now.
There's an entire class of actors where we forget that in their 20s they were smoking hot. I wouldn't say people have forgotten this, but if you watch Warren Beatty's old movies, he's one of the hottest people who ever lived. Whereas if you watch him in Shampoo or Heaven Can Wait, he looks good, but not especially eye-popping.
Baby, I watched Splendor in the Grass the other week because it was on Turner Classic Movies.
Hottest man who ever lived, yes.
Don't we get a young Jodie Foster?
Paul Newman would like a word, but Warren Beatty was so hot. I was like, I see why you were fucking him, Madonna.
Right, exactly. No, when Madonna did an interview once with Howard Stern talking about the Warren Beatty era, and you can tell she was still sort of in awe of him, like 30 years on. I totally get it.
Yes, young Jodie Foster is in that movie. I was sort of going on a sort of Scorsese rewatch, and I'm watching the ones I've never seen and rewatching the ones that I don't remember. Because for me, like, if I saw, like, a film in high school or, like, early college, I don't remember it well to have do it. So that's why I rewatched Taxi Driver and I rewatched Casino last night. But romantic drama, I watched for the first time The Age of Innocence, which is hot.
Oh, I know it's hot. And also another movie that...
Daniel Day-Lewis, so sexy as young, but even sexier in the documentary on the making of, where he just has, like, a beard and an ascot. And looks modern because Daniel only does period pieces.
Right. That's a movie that casually has some of the most beautiful people who have ever been on the silver screen in it. You know, just Michelle Pfeiffer looking unreal, Winona Ryder looking unreal.
Richard Grant is in it. The Winona thing, by the way, I just want to bring up, there was a woman who responded to my tweet that I was watching The Age of Innocence, and she said, oh, such a beautiful movie, except for Winona Ryder. And I was like, what? Excuse me? And I said, we respect Miss Ryder in this house, baby. And she said, she can't act her way out of a paper bag. And then typed runs away. I'm like, listen, bitch. There's this whole class of people who think that just because they don't like Winona in Stranger Things, somehow she's always been an awful actress. And I just want to say that that is not true.
Yeah.
I would compare her to Kristen Stewart, which is to say she is very capable in a certain string. Like, if you watch Clouds of Sils Maria, Kristen Stewart is great. However, there is a stiltedness and a... Occasionally, the look in her eyes is just blank to me. So I think she vacillates in and out of good performances sometimes.
I would say it works in Age of Innocence because she's supposed to be playing this sort of meek character who you then realize has manipulated Daniel Day-Lewis out of his relationship with Michelle Pfeiffer. They were writing more roles suited to an actress like her in the 80s.
Right, the moodiness, the sardonicness.
Yeah, in Beetlejuice and like Heathers, like you don't really see the her role on Stranger Things isn't that. She's supposed to be like this nervous mother who's like
mom,
constantly crying about her son, right? And like she doesn't have that sort of attitude that she should have. Like, she should be playing like an Edie Britt kind of character.
I don't think Stranger Things is necessarily suited to her talents, personally.
I don't think Stranger Things is suited to a lot of things. like being good.
Yeah.
For one.
I'm glad that this is being talked about here, because I had to experience Stranger Things pre-Keep It podcast and just looking at all my friends being like, what is this? Why
are
we...
The first season is white excellence. The first season is white excellence. The rest of it... Sort of a mess. Yeah. It should have been a movie. Anyway, I guess that's it. Wrapping up, I will say that speaking of romantic trilogies, you know which one I've never seen? Bridget Jones.
Any of them?
Any of them.
I will say once you've seen the first one, I think you can kind of gather what comes next. But I mean...
I've seen the third one, I think, in the waiting room of like a doctor's office and was like, Patrick Dempsey's in this? What? And then just like kept it moving.
I feel like Renee is somebody we can always stand to revisit because movies like Nurse Betty just haven't stuck in the cultural imagination as much.
One of my first films, yes.
Rewatched Nurse Betty the other week, and people do not remember that she makes out with Morgan Freeman in that movie.
Oof.
Oh, that's imprinted in my memory.
Disgusting.
There's no way.
Anyway, when we're back, Daveed Diggs. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of black stories, black truths.
Black perspectives have always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as very nuanced and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a three-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts.
After pulling double duty as both Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson in Hamilton on Broadway, and scoring a Grammy and a Tony in the process, our new guest became a fixture on big and small screens, because you can currently catch him on TNT's Snowpiercer, an adaptation of the Bong Joon-ho film Snowpiercer. It is a post-apocalyptic thriller following the passengers of the Snowpiercer, a giant, perpetually moving train that circles the globe and carrying the remnants of humanity 7 years after it became a frozen wasteland. Welcome, Daveed. Congrats on being our first Tony winner here, as Lewis mentioned earlier.
Hello.
Hello.
We really believe in the sanctity of awards around here. Like, you know, it's better than God and religion, et cetera. So really, this is a spiritual fulfillment for us.
I totally understand. I totally get it. We all do it for the awards.
How's it going in the midst of this quarantine? I feel like I interviewed you for Playboy literally weeks before
I know
this happened.
How crazy. That was a great interview, by the way. Thank you for that. That was really...
Oh, thank you.
They're not often good ones. And yeah. So when they are, it's dope. Things are good. As good as, like, other than the crippling anxiety, I think everything's pretty smooth. Like, I'm still crazy busy, which I don't think is the goal, but happens to be true and allows me to sort of just keep focused on things and keep feeling like I'm producing things, which is great. I'm super fortunate. I have a great place to be sheltered in. Look at this wallpaper. Like, you know, I mean, I'm doing good. I'm with my girlfriend, and that's amazing. You know, we never get to spend this much time together. So there are so many like upsides to my current situation. Mm-hmm. The major downside being like, I don't see a way out yet, and we have no actual leadership in this country, so you know.
Yeah. For people who can't see it, by the way, the background is very exquisite. It's very Rainforest Cafe, Caribbean restaurant. Right.
With chic, yes.
Miss Lily's in Harlem sort of vibe. I like it.
This is actually, this room has been appearing on a lot of, you know, morning shows and talk shows and stuff, and every time it happens, my mom goes, "That's my room," because whenever she stays here, she stays in this room.
That has been the weirdest thing about this pandemic, you know, just the insight into people's homes, you know, and seeing just like where people live. And normally we would not see that unless it was an Architectural Digest spread. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny. Early on, I started, because I was getting all these requests in for podcasts or interviews or whatever, and I would like be in a different room in the house every time, you know, just trying to like
spice it up.
And then my girlfriend was like, "Will you stop showing our house to the world?" And you're like, "What are you doing? Just go outside and do it in front of our address. Why don't you?" Yeah. All right, solid point.
I remain so disturbed by when we saw Meryl Streep perform Ladies Who Lunch with Christine Baranski and Audra McDonald, because I shouldn't know anything about her home. It really frightens me that I had that level of intimacy with her.
Yeah. It's weird. There is too much access, turns out.
Okay, well, we have to talk about Snowpiercer, because one, when I watched this show, it occurred to me, my memory of the movie is strong for a couple of reasons, namely Tilda Swinton, who is just one of my all-time favorite performers anyway. Yeah. So to move the plot along and I think cleverly change it so that the protagonist is a detective, I was just interested in how they could transfer that strange and loopy grittiness to a episodes long show. So when you prepared for this role, did you watch the movie at all, or watch it several times, or not care?
No, I watched it early on when I was sent a pilot script. I had never seen it, and I didn't know anything about it. So I watched the movie, and then I realized that was based on some graphic novels. So I read those graphic novels. This was all before I even auditioned for the thing, just because I'm in the task of making the decision whether or not to do a project. I'm a nerd, and I know how betrayed I feel when something I'm a fan of like gets fucked up, basically. So so it was mostly me doing my due diligence to make sure that whatever the show was trying to do was going to feel substantively different from the existing versions of it, so that it didn't have to live up to a thing. And it felt like it did to me. It felt like it was attempting at least to do a thing that is the reason to make something in a TV show, which is to sort of more deeply explore some of the underlying issues that particularly the film brings up, but that you have to sort of run by the virtue of a 90-minute time limit and like a heist setup. So that's what excited me about the project. You know, we would sort of talk about the film and the graphic novels on set all the time, but just as sort of like interest, if there were interesting parallels coming up, but we didn't ever feel like we had to look at it for character or for plot. I think they sort of smartly set this in a different time than either of those things take place and allowed it to sort of be its own world.
One of the things I want to ask you about too is, this is a piece that actually didn't even make it to the interview because we had to cut stuff for time, was working with Jennifer Connelly. I know that you told me, you know, a lot about learning from her on set. Yeah. And I think that when we were watching it, we were like, oh yeah, there she is. You know, like an actress that we love. And it's nice seeing her in this forefront again. What was it like just working with her on set? Because, you know, you had a really fun story about that.
Before. Oh yeah, I don't remember what story I told you, but she's, you know, she is like the most prepared actor I've ever worked with, I'm not. So I did a lot of just learning from her. I mean, if I had to do a scene with Jennifer, like kind of the goal was like just don't get showed up too much, you know, like I like punching above my weight a little bit. Like, she's better than me by any metric, I think, by any of my own personal like metrics. She's been doing it longer and she has more techniques and she's capable of very easily accessing things that take me a long time and a lot of effort to access. And I like working with people like that. And she's such a giving performer and actor. And what I generally do as a stage performer is trust my directors so much to sort of set up everything. But it's different in TV because the directors are in and out. The actors are the only people who are there the whole time, really. So it makes sense that it kind of falls on you to set the tone and the atmosphere. And like that tends to fall on the people who are high up, who have, you know, are 1 and 2 or 1, 2, and 3 on a call sheet. Like, that's sort of your job, is to make sure that the environment is conducive to actually getting work done. And Jennifer does that so well. And I aspire to be that good at such things.
I have to say, though, I find Jennifer Connelly, generally speaking, intimidating seeming. I literally worked this out on Twitter one day. I was like, is it that she seems mean or does she just have long, straight hair? I can't tell.
Long, straight, black hair, yeah. Yes. It's the dark hair.
And
it's the Shigo effect.
One of my favorite movies of the 2000s is Little Children, where I think that's my favorite role of hers, period. Was she intimidating as well as educational in terms of her experience?
Yes, until her daughter came to set one time. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay. I get, like, the way that she loves her kids, and that's also like most of what she talks about if we're not shooting, is her kids. Like, she loves her kids so much. And that was like, oh, that's the side of this you don't get to see. Just made sense. Like, she's an incredible mom in the same way that she's an incredible actor, you know.
David, I know that like none of us could have predicted that Snowpiercer's release would have coincided with the world ending, but you know, like, and you know, since the train is a metaphor very clearly for capitalism and class, and you guys are actually like dispelling a lot of strong questions in Snowpiercer, how do you hope people will receive watching Snowpiercer right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky right now. I hope that people are first and foremost entertained, because I don't know like what we need more than that I can give necessarily. But beyond that, you know, the ideas that it brings up about how capitalism does not work the same for everybody by design, and how, you know, particularly when it starts to interact with resource scarcity, how that maybe is not the best way to live, or at least is something that should be examined, is an important thing that I think we're all thinking about right now because we interact with it on a daily basis. I do think those are important to think about, and I hope that people are not depressed by them so much as just aware of and inspired by, particularly, you know, in an election year coming up, on a very important election, which no, you know, no matter how ambivalent you are about your particular candidate, like, is going to set the tone for the next very long time in this country.
Talking a bit too about your work in theater, which you brought up, Hamilton is also coming out soon, and people are going to be able to see that.
July 3rd?
July 3rd.
I feel like that was such a big internet phenomenon too, in a way that theater hadn't been before. Like, we saw some of it again with like Slave Play, but you know, like everyone talking about it. And what's it feel like now, you know, to feel like that, particularly in this era now, you know, like it was already going to come out, but like now it's coming out while everyone's home. Like, it's sort of this democratization of Hamilton, you know, like so many people who have been obsessed with the music can see it now if they couldn't get to New York to see it before, or it hadn't toured where they were.
Yeah, I am. The democratization of it is the best part of it, I think. For a long time, particularly early on, you know, while I was still doing it, it was such a weird sort of status symbol to have seen Hamilton, you know?
Yeah.
And like, it became like, it was just this thing that rich people talk about at parties, like, well, did you see Hamilton, you know? And then after the cast turned over, it's like, well, I saw it with the original cast. So, and what I like about this coming out is that it's like, fuck you. Now everybody will have seen it with most of the original cast. So like, now you have to find something else to brag to your friends about. And like, it seems like the thing still makes people really happy. Like, I don't know, just granted, like my DMs are skewed for shit that people want to talk to me about. But like, I still like every day the amount of people who just will write something about that they've been listening to the cast album or whatever, or something that the music has done for them. Like, people use it in a way that I never had thought of. Particularly like a musical soundtrack to be used, like kids getting ready for their tests, or like people gearing up for auditions or going into job interviews. Like, people are using it as like get hype music, like inspiration music. And that there's something really nice about that. And so I think it coming out now when influxes of joy are particularly valuable, I'm happy about that. Mm-hmm. The part that scares me about it is that I'm going to have to watch myself do it at some point. And I've never seen myself do that. And I hate watching myself do things. And it is the thing I have done that still the most people talk about. And I think the only reason I'm able to sort of stay in public and like not just melt into a little ball anytime anyone talks about it is because I haven't seen it. So I don't have to form an opinion on what I did. Whereas now I'm going to have to do that, which will be very, very difficult. But in the world of champagne problems, I guess.
You mentioned earlier how when you're in the theater, a big part of what you do is just trusting your director. Do you remember in the conversations with your director ahead of Hamilton premiering, any particular conversation that made it dawn on you that this was going to be like a theater altering event? Do you have any specific interaction where you thought like, oh wait, something else is happening here that is not just, you know, the theater I've been acquainted with so far?
No. And this is the sort of the brilliant thing about Tommy Kail, I think, as a director and a human and like a friend, as someone who I just call when I, you know, am stressed out. He is very good at protecting the thing. And so we in rehearsals felt like any other rehearsal. And he was so careful, even through the years of like the development phases when we were doing sort of workshops or sing-throughs or whatever. He was so careful about who was allowed to see it and when they were allowed to see it. And he would manage that up to the day. Like, there were moments where we were supposed to have kind of relatively public presentations of a bunch of songs that we worked on. And he would sort of the day of be like, man, the songs aren't quite where we want to let that many people in yet. So he would just say, we're going to sing this for us. I told everybody to go home. So when it did become this, what it became for me, it was pretty shocking. To sort of like every time there's a new, you know, article written about it or more celebrities backstage or something, it was just like, this is a play, guys. I don't know what y'all thought it was. Like, this actually, it's just a play. I don't know.
I really do think of it also as a celebrity event, though. Like, weirdly, I remember seeing Rosie O'Donnell on the then new Match Game saying, I've seen it 14 times or something. Yes. And then it occurred to me, like, you talked about it being a status conversation, but also, like, this thing where it got celebrities who normally are just promoting their own stuff talking about popular art with each other in front of us.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was ever strange. Like, who have you ever seen talk about Hamilton that, I'll say, blew your mind?
You know, like, I have been on like Steph Curry had a has a great show, 5 Minutes from Home. He had like a great web series, and like I have been on that because of Hamilton. You know that like those kinds of things blow my mind. Like that my I'm having interactions with heroes of mine, totally outside of the world of theater or even performance, really, like athletes who are like obsessed. Like, he tells me he plays my shot, like warming up for basketball games. Like, that is so dorky. And also, like, so amazing, right? Like, what? How is that even possible? And then, like, hang out with his family and, like, his kids are singing the Skylar Sisters song to me. It's like, what a wild world, you know? Even early on, we did a BET cipher for the BET Awards that year. Like, there was a Hamilton cipher with, like, me and Lynn and Black Thought. And, I've been a rapper my whole life. If you had were to tell me that I had to go to Broadway to get on a fucking BET cipher, I
would be like, with Black Thought.
That doesn't make any sense. You know what I'm saying? Like, the way that it sort of permeated popular culture is like very rare for as any like theater practitioner will tell you. That does not happen very often. And maybe has never happened in a way like that, because I don't know that we have had a show where the point of it, where somewhere baked into the fabric of it was this idea of inclusivity in the same way. A lot of it is weird and still feels weird.
And not even inclusivity in the sense of like, that is the concept of the show, you know, like not in theme. It's like, this is the way it's presented, which I think helped to make it really sort of more universal, particularly to like what theater kids, you know, like people who love it so much growing up, you know, it's like, it reminds you of high school or college when like you could play any role, right? You know, and that changes when you go into the real world, you know, and it's like you can't always play every single role that you would maybe be cast in as a kid. And so I think that, you know, it's this idea of theater being for everyone. And I do like that now, like so many people can see it. Has this sort of period changed how you're even approaching the art you want to make now, or how you want to get art to people, just because of this coronavirus shit?
It has. It's been I think I was in a lot of ways kind of spiraling towards a very necessary slowdown. You know, when we talked, Ira, I was like running around like crazy anyway. And right before this shutdown, I was on this crazy sort of loop between Vancouver, where we're still shooting Snowpiercer, the second season. And then I was flying to London, working on something I'm not allowed to talk about. And then coming back to...
You're the new Spider-Man. We got it.
Yeah. And then LA also, for either press stuff or recording sessions for Central Park, or, you know, any of the various Bob's Burgers or any of the other like animated projects I'm working on. And then while I was in LA, I would have like 4 or 5 other meetings that I had been putting off because I was outside of LA. So it was just this kind of crazy time with too much travel, and this crazy sort of split focus where I was always having to sleep on an airplane and land and just kind of wake up into a new mode. And it was pretty unsustainable. And also like making me not particularly good at anything. I was doing a lot, but I don't know how much of it was really good. And particularly in some things that are really important to me, like music making, like it was so hard to write a song, when I am not sitting down at all, you know. And then other, you know, personal life things, obviously, like my relationship with my partner was struggling. That's hard to be away from each other like that. What this time has really done, I think, is made me kind of try to figure out how I can still participate in a lot of things, but like be smarter about the way I am participating and be a little more realistic with myself about my capacity. So I've taken on like some more producing side things, you know, helping folks develop scripts or even just getting them placed places using kind of the sort of what I have been gaining a lot over the last few years is a better understanding of how things get made and what different studios or production entities or whatever are looking for. And I have a lot more connections than I used to have. I just know more people. And so that becomes really useful when friends of mine have great projects that should get made, but like nobody knows who they are, but they know who I am. So all I have to do is make an introduction and then fade into the background, you know, and I have the capacity for that. yeah. So I'm trying to refocus in that way and probably do more behind the scenes and less in front of a camera. And just less traveling, seeing what else I can do from either where I am or wherever my partner is, because she's in the business too. And if she has to go shoot somewhere, I'll go there. If I'm not shooting something, I'd rather maximize our time together.
One final question. When you see a Lin-Manuel Miranda tweet that ends with good night, do you say good night back to it? Or-
yeah, I every time I see one, I call him and I say good night. He's talking directly to me. So I tuck Lin in most nights.
Okay, good. I was worried. Yeah.
It really is. He's reaching out. He wants everybody to do that.
Each one a cry for help. Noted. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you so much, David, for being here.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Oh,
yeah,
thank
it's good
you
to talk to you again. Yeah. Everyone should watch The Snowpiercer. It's on Sunday nights.
TNT.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, guys. This was really fun. Let's do it again anytime.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.
As the class of 2020 graduates into a world beset by a global pandemic and economic anxiety and unprecedented unemployment, I will say, welcome to me and Lewis's graduation years.
Right.
Oh, yeah. It's the same.
I graduated from journalism school in 2008, and the commencement address was like, why the fuck did you major in journalism?
That's so disrespectful.
Yeah, and I graduated in 2011 after that financial crisis from graduate school, and Bill Clinton was our speaker.
Oh,
and
damn.
a lot of it was like, so, no jobs, financial crisis. Anyway, welcome to the world.
What are y'all
going to
do?
But the class of 2020, because they have been hunkered down at home, thanks to stay-at-home orders, has had everyone and their mother emerging on Zoom to give them advice. You know, they're getting their commencement speeches broadcast to the world. There are a few highlights.
Sure.
And there are a few what the fuck.
Definitely
moments.
A lot of what the fucks.
Overall, I'm a little bit disappointed at how many celebrity commencement addresses I've seen rely on the idea that the graduation isn't what's important. Like, they haven't taken much away from you. It's like, when you're an adult, your life is demarcated by fewer gigantic events like that. So, no, something has been taken from you. Let's be clear.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And acknowledge that. Yeah.
Let's first talk about these memorable commencement speeches before we sort of launch into a convo about commencement speeches in general. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there is Barack Obama's speech, which was fine on an Obama scale speech, right? I mean, he's done better, but it wasn't actually awful. I did not need a Tiger King reference.
No.
I don't. Mm-hmm. I never need it. And they, like, multiple speeches that we're about to talk about reference Tiger King. Why? What? Who is that for?
Whoever they hired to do the speech writing was like, that's what the kids like. They're watching Tiger King. I feel like it was mostly kids as parents and people our age watching Tiger King. But anyway.
Yeah, I liked Obama's main speech. Though the part where he allegedly drags Trump and says, a lot of so-called grown-ups out there. I mean, that's a little... I thought that was a little immature for addressing 18 and 22-year-olds.
Yes.
Yes. The thing about Obama is that he always wants to drag Trump, and it's always figuring out a way that he can do it. And sometimes he's good at it, and this one I felt like was just sort of weirdly worded.
It was meek, and he didn't want the speech to feel like a tirade against Trump. I get it. Mm-hmm. It just, yeah. There's something about the phrase so-called grown-ups that feels like, you know, a Rugrats TV sequel.
The Obama one, I mean, again, I think it was like lacking a level of compassion that I think these children need and probably deserve. And I know that I don't think that Obama just missed them. I think that they still look at Obama as a figure that that they could glean something from. My favorite one was LeBron James's, I think, out of all of them that I listened to. At least his had like a call to action. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And he went out of his way to be like, center this around community. Like, yeah, you can't go outside right now, but outside in your nearest people, the people around you in the community that you have, is all that we can really focus our energy on. And that was endearing to me. And his hairline was looking right for the first time in a while. So
I eat it. don't be dragging Bron's hairline. I'm like,
he tried
I'm
it.
Like, what you think of mine?
You know who addressed everybody with a dignity that was expected? But if I were her, I would have gone nasty, is Malala. She said, the class of 2020 won't be defined by what we lost to this virus, but by how we responded to it. The world is yours now, and I can't wait to see what you make of it. If I were Malala, I'd be like, when I was your age, I had a Nobel Prize, sweetie. And look at you now, stuck in a goddamn living room. You
crying
will never be me.
Oh, Malala.
Yeah. it does bring up the idea of what commencement speeches should be for, right? I mean, like, we've all experienced them. Mm-hmm. I don't really recall my high school commencement speech at all. I do know that our dean of students, Mr. Bob Herman, gave that commencement speech. And I do remember that at one point he was a silver fox, and I liked looking at him. Did not like hearing him speak, though. He sort of droned on like a robot.
That's what high school's all about. Not paying attention to who's up there, but knowing that they're hot. That's what life is.
Yes. The class of 2020, yes, you're at home. Yes, there's a lot of this shit going on. But let me tell you, you do not want to experience several hours of sitting somewhere while multiple people talk forever. Commencement speeches are long as fuck. Graduation ceremonies are long as fuck.
Yeah.
This will contradict the advice I have to graduates that we'll get to in a second, but I was surprised how little I remembered the content of some of the speeches, other than somebody made a long, extended choose your own adventure metaphor, to which I say, I already knew life was about making choices, so you did a bad job here.
Weird. I very unfortunately do remember it. My high school commencement speech was from Pete Ricketts.
Well, it was last year.
Leave me alone. It was actually 5 years ago, and I had to grace the stage with that half turtle, half man, Pete Ricketts.
Wow.
And he gave a very meandering speech about, well, because we're supposed to have a poet laureate come, the Nebraska poet laureate, but then he dropped out last minute, and we got that walking Q-tip, Pete Ricketts. So, yeah, I mean, he tried his best. He really did. Do you guys remember who you had for your college commencement speeches?
I've tried looking up the information. I specifically think that Brian Grazer talked to the Tisch commencement at NYU. Like, you're in different schools, and then there's the larger graduation. At the larger graduation, Bill Clinton spoke.
Okay.
That was at the baseball stadium. But at Javits Center, I'm pretty sure it was Brian Grazer, but I've tried Googling it and cannot find anything about that speech. I specifically think I remember it was Brian Grazer because I think his daughter was graduating at the time. So that's why he spoke.
If Brian Grazer didn't bring up his wife, Gigi Lavangi Grazer, who wrote the movie Stepmom and also hosted the logo reality series The Arrangement about arranging flowers, it was not worth it.
But Bill Clinton's speech is actually a very memorable one. It's listed on Forbes and Esquire's list of like best commencement speeches. It was really just a speech, you know, sort of about how like the current world that we live in is unequal and unstable. we had come off that financial crisis that happened when Obama first became president, like 2009. And if a lot, looking back on that speech, so many of the similarities between then and now were very stark, you know, like quotes like, the world is unstable, not just because violence can cross borders and non-state actors can cause trouble, but because disease can cross borders, because the financial crisis, which sadly began here, spread almost instantaneously, first to the United Kingdom, then to Ireland, then to Iceland, then to the exporting countries because the people couldn't afford to buy their products. You know, it's talking about how a financial crisis was instigated here and sort of spread globally. And it's talking about disease and things that were on our minds then and really should have been on the minds of a competent administration now, but is not. And that ownership, too, of our role in so many of those things is refreshing because, I mean, we didn't talk about that stand-up comedian from The Creek, Ben Sasse.
Oh, from Aida's neck of the woods. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
What a baffling speech. What a baffling speech. Because he was definitely
going,
this guy goes on an extended metaphor about gym class where he disses gym teachers and then
his
says,
father.
Correct. And then says, like, climb the rope. We all remember climbing a rope. Some of you don't remember climbing a rope. Like, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And it never lands on funny.
Also implies that, like, classes now don't know what ropes are. I'm pretty sure they still have the rope in gym class, but also says that older generations were fitter than current generations. I'm like, really? Younger generations are doing CrossFit.
Bro, he called them unfit. He calls them lazy. He calls them like, and he calls them lazy while we're in a pandemic, like makes jokes about them kind of like being couch potatoes in a way. Sir, where am I supposed to go to receive this information? I only have one room. And the thing with Ben Sasse is, so I do remember meeting Ben Sasse when I was still in Nebraska. And I want you guys to know his hands are cold to the touch. He might be a reptile as well. That might be the theme for.
He looks exactly like the Midwestern man that the really hot girl, you know, from high school ends up marrying instead of the hot guy that she dated in high school.
Wow.
That's very, very accurate. Very.
Thank you for that poem
accurate.
About the suburbs you just recited. Wow.
Just call me Arcade Fire. But I'm looking at Ben Sasse's history too. First of all, I hate this Republican talking point of adopting rhetoric of lazy Gen Z, millennials, et cetera, as if he was in the war. It's like or even waxing poetic about the war like they're fucking Ernest Hemingway. It's like, bitch, you were not in the military. So what is this whole thing about, like, oh, we were more fit than you, and it's like, you're all lazy. Sir, you're 48.
Also, the entire idea of, like, one generation having more, whatever, experience or anything than a younger generation is just pathetic and age-old, and, like, the same story we've been telling ourselves for 100 years.
And there's so many people online trying to, like, recently, there was someone in the UK, like, waxing poetic about, like, World War II and shit like that. Like, this sort of myth that everyone in original World Wars was like lining up on the front line to lay down their lives for their country. I'm like, pick up a fucking book. Wars have been protested for generations. Also, there's this idea that he's supposed to be the young voice of the Republican Party. He's not old as fuck like most old white men who are in the Republican Party. And so I could see why he was trying to joke because it's like, he seems like someone who's trying to stick in the minds of youth because he's planning, like, maybe a presidential run or something that in the future. But the whole blaming China so many times, the weird thing about the name Jeremy, I just didn't get it. And it reminds me why Republicans aren't funny. And I sort of don't want to see him again, but I'm pretty sure we will, judging from that speech.
It's a certain thing that I think also goes along with being a conservative or being a Republican, which is a lack of awareness, which is what you need to be like a funny person. So it was very uncomfortable, but unfortunately, it's not unlike my experience with old white men in Nebraska, and I'm sure you guys can speak to this because it's a very common Midwest sentiment, but it was the most Ben Sasse speech that I think he could have given.
Yeah. Well, also, to Aida's point, a big part of being funny is wanting to relate to other people as opposed mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. taking all your toys and going home, which is, you know, the motto of the Republican Party.
Yeah. Yeah.
And really just sort of speaking down to people, too. Unfortunately,
I do think the best commencement moment belongs to Cardi B, who said, "Don't let no coronavirus or no nothing take this special moment from you. That's all you need."
That's it. That's it.
She's truly been the public speaker of our time.
I remember what she says every time.
Cardi could run for president. Cardi could run for president, and I might not vote for her, but I would hesitate. Do you understand what I'm saying? I would think about it.
You would respect the thought.
You'd be kombucha girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would donate money so that she could be on the ballot.
Yes. I want to see her make it to the top. I do.
Yeah, she deserves to be in the primary.
So what advice do you guys have for actual graduates? Do we have anything we want to say to young people who are unfortunately going to deal with the world, which I don't recommend, but okay.
I feel goofy giving graduates any advice, but I will try my best. I really want them to know that, like, and, you know, this is probably what you guys experienced too, coming out into the, you know, economic crisis or after it, is that by nature of being in that thing, you are the most resilient class of people that have come, like, since anyone before you. So I think that these kids are going to be, like, they're going to operate on a totally different level of innovation than we, I think, have ever even been forced to. I just want them to take the skills and the knowledge that they've learned and try to turn that into something that is modern and capable for this time that we're living in. But they got it. They'll be fine.
I would say that history is not something to be afraid of. You know, a lot of older people for generations are always going to be talking down to younger people, saying that our generation was doing something different. You know, your generation is a little bit lazier. You're in your sweatpants at home, et cetera. But I would say that learn from generations before you and keep, you know, moving forward with your own innovation. You know, I think that young people will always be smart, always be the future of this country. And I think that whatever you need to do to forge your path in the world is right for you. You know, you look at how even the three of us would have the careers that we have now. That wasn't the path for so many other people. And I think that you create your own avenues. Something like this, a podcast, what didn't even exist in this form mm-hmm. when we graduated? Television writing didn't exist the way it did now with all sorts of digital platforms back even in 2008 when I first graduated from college. So, you know, just look around at what you would like to do and find whatever way you can to make that happen. And build a community too, you know? You're not the only person going through this. There are so many other people who are experiencing this very fraught moment.
My one piece of advice for everybody, and this is something I actually do, is remember everything. It's a good rule of thumb, whether you're exhilarated or devastated or things are working out for you or not working out for you or you're just fucking bored, be like Joan Didion with her damn notebooks. Find a way to remember even the minute things about your life, because I feel like it all adds up to something, and eventually one day you may need it for a book or a podcast or a game show where Jane Fonda is your literal teammate. This is my life. Sometimes I feel like I'm the only person who remembers the mediocre biopic DeLovely, but I know that Kevin Kline slayed and we got an Alanis Morissette cover of Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love. Everything is worth something. So train yourself to remember. Don't rely on Wikipedia to remember it for you. Your life's an accumulation and your memory makes it great.
Yeah. Definitely agree with what you just said. I think it was when Aida and I talked about David Sedaris in a previous podcast, thinking about a humorist who writes about their life in such amazing and introspective detail, sort of inspired me to remember to write things down.
Yeah.
You know?
I truly, the only thing I regret are things I don't remember, because I truly got nothing from them, you know?
Yeah.
Wish I could dig up my old Lime journal.
Oh.
Where I would write things down after school every day. I'm sure it would be embarrassing, but it would also be a reminder of the emotions that I was going through.
I want to read about all my mundane, like, fourth grade crushes. And, like, I would, like, write down every time they looked at me. That is the type of, that's the level of detail I'm trying to find.
All right. When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It.
Things are going to get kept.
We're ready for another one of Aida's lies.
This one I can promise you.
What are you pretending to keep this week?
This one I promise you is true and consistent and will remain this way because this man has continued to fail me for the past three albums now. Now, I know that I come here and complain about rappers a lot, but that's because I have so much faith in the Rap Boys, but they always fail me, especially recently. And I don't know if it's because this is the like natural curve of becoming a rapper where you work really hard at the beginning and then you get success and you stop working hard and you just release whatever. It's like a natural laziness. But Future's new album came out, and I don't know if you boys are Future fans. I would assume you're not, but I don't want to make any assumptions.
Aida,
now, who knows?
You know I'm a Future fan.
I know you like ignorance, so I should have yes. I should have allowed that.
I've seen Future live.
Really? How was that?
It was fine.
It was cute.
I think it was at Outside Lands in SF.
Mm, okay.
I'm a fan of keeping up on Sierra and how she's doing, so that's fair. Don't know. Yeah,
that's fair. But yeah, so I love the ignorant Atlanta rap. I'm so disappointed by this album. This album that he just dropped on the 15th. It's called High Off Life, and he has coronavirus bars in it, which I don't know if I'm not at the point yet where I can accept coronavirus references in music and pop culture that aren't talking about it. Like, I don't like, his bars are like coronavirus diamonds, like he's got the flu. It's disgusting. Also, rappers, stop making references to having a sickness because you're so icy. Like, every single rap song has it. Move on. Find something else. Be more creative. Now, he really tried. Future did really try, but don't listen to his album. I will give you so many other albums that came out this week that are way better than the Future album. Charlie XCX made an album. She made it entirely in quarantine. Like, she made it in 1 month. It's beautiful. Listen to that. Moses Sumney has an album. All these people that are making way better music than Future is making right now. So that's it.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because we did get to talk about that in our culture section. But Moses Sumney, Perfume Genius right now,
My God.
Giving me queer anthems right now, and they're both just like moody, introspective albums. Moses is like, he has Jill Scott on it, so it's yes. giving you that like neo soul vibe. The Perfume Genius album is sort of like beach dream pop, and I love that shit.
Everybody, so listen to these albums so that we can talk about them next week. Watch the Colors show where he performs Cut Me, and he looks absolutely astounding. That's my only assignment to you guys. That's it.
Soon we get Chromatica by Lady Gaga, and we also get Dedicated B-Side, if the Insta is steering me right, from Carly Rae Jepsen. So pretty soon queer people won't be shutting up about music. So just be aware that you're going to be hit with an onslaught of
the gay bops.
Excitable tweets. Yeah.
Carly Rae Jepsen releasing a B-side to an album? I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. This is unprecedented.
Lewis, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it is to something that I find very well-intentioned and, generally speaking, is pretty cool with some artistic exceptions. I am talking about
the Second Amendment?
Close. That's right. I'm talking about the EW Pride cover, which is this cartoonified, Where's Waldo-looking assemblage of queer people in popular culture. So you see Elton John and RuPaul and Ellen DeGeneres and Janelle Monáe and even Freddie Mercury. There's some historical people in there. If you scan to the right, you see Marlena Dietrich slow dancing with Cynthia Nixon, which I'm not saying I haven't had that dream. I just was shocked to see it realized on a magazine cover. Now, here's the thing. It's meant to look like one of those murals you see on Hollywood Boulevard where Marilyn Monroe is hanging out with James Dean and John Wayne. Like, it's not supposed to make logical sense. So in that way, it's cool to see a version of that with only queer performers, new and old. It's like seeing a gay version, a gayer version of the rap from Vogue realized in illustration form. However, between George Takei and Lil Nas X, who of course are both next to each other on this cover, in the background on the floor is The Brick from Stonewall. I say this with affection. Nobody here had anything to do with Stonewall. It's like if you looked in the background and saw Harvey Milk's tombstone. It's just completely out of place. It feels like a glib addition to a picture that would have been perfectly cute otherwise. But now I look at this picture and think, this is about the Stonewall riots secretly. It's just a strange Easter egg to find in an illustration. A better Easter egg, though, is that George Takei, I just realized right now as I do this Keep It, is holding a magazine with Katie Lang on the cover. That's what I'm talking about.
The first issue of Entertainment Weekly.
That's cute.
The first Entertainment Weekly.
Oh, that's what that is. See, that's really cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I cackled so much at the Stonewall Brick.
I just,
what the fuck I do? Why am I in it? Like, first of all, nary a Marsha P. Johnson on the cover.
I don't see
truly,
her.
Truly.
And the Brick, the fuck did the Brick do?
A gay icon, the Brick.
Someone picked up the Brick. The Brick was minding its own business.
The Brick's a conservative homophobe. We don't even know.
The Brick was a bit of a centrist. Yeah. Right.
And then also, Dorothy's shoe is on the piano.
I will say, I mean, like, that cues into, like, the whole friend of Dorothy.
Yeah. But I don't know. There's so many weird misfires in this. There's a lot of white people, for one. Like,
am I looking at Ryan Murphy?
That's correct. Yes.
Which I would assume would be on it, but the garb is not what I would have expected to represent him.
Well,
I'm just
it's
not...
his Liberace look from the Met Gala camp last year.
Boo.
And the thing is, you have Ryan Murphy on here, who, fine, he's the current ringmaster of queer shows on television.
Sure.
Where are the queer people who are in those shows, though?
Exactly.
You know, like, where's a Billy Porter?
That's...
Where's an India Moore? You know, mm-hmm. It is very lax. Sort of the person thing that a white gay would dream up, right?
I'm looking at one trans person on the spread.
I looked at the Instagram of the person who created it, and, you know, he's British and has muscles and he's hot.
Boo.
So, you know, a white gay dream. It sort of looks like the black paintings that you see in Harlem, the ones of, like, Aaliyah and, like, Biggie mm-hmm. and MLK mm-hmm. and Rosa Parks, like, all in heaven together for some damn reason, hanging out. But then also, like, Michelle Obama's in it,
yeah,
too.
Like, they have an African-American caucus in heaven. But I want to know why they put all of the, they put, like, Lil Nas X, Laverne Cox, Janelle Monáe, RuPaul, all on the first page, and then there's no black people on the second part of the spread, like the half part, the other half of the spread. Very
strange.
That
is true. Yes.
Very strange.
Like I said, it's a white gay thinking of the famous gay people that they remember immediately, mm-hmm. and then at the end, it's like, well, you sort of left these ones out, and they're like, well, I had to get in Marlene Dietrich and Rock Hudson, and I know that some people were dragging Rock Hudson this week.
Oh, yeah.
I get it. We shouldn't really be attacking him, but also, he wasn't out, you know? And, like, what's happened to him was unfortunate, being in the closet his career, and his death was very sad as well, and it brought to light the AIDS epidemic. But it seems almost Ryan Murphy Hollywood-esque to include him on it too, right? Mm-hmm. Because so many of these other people are living out loud, and this gay fantasia on mundane themes.
I was wondering how you were going to end that sentence. Yeah. Yeah. The conclusion of Rock Hudson does feel like it's just promo for Netflix's Hollywood. They could have thrown in out gay man Sal Mineo of Rebel Without a Cause fame, who was eventually nominated for a second Oscar for a movie called Exodus.
And he's cute.
Yeah. Oh, he's adorable. Right. But I just want to say also, though, apparently Kristen Stewart tops Lily Tomlin. I had no idea. And I'm thrilled to see it.
I want Kate McKinnon in the front. That's what I want. That's my only change, really. Stonewall Brick can stay. Kate McKinnon comes to the front.
She should be slow dancing with the Brick. Come on.
Or like holding it and kissing it.
Whew.
Ira, do you have a Keep It this week?
My Keep It this week is to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I have to agree.
We talked about this last week when I was talking about Adele, right? Like, keep people's bodies out of your mouth. And I get it that we hate Donald Trump. Listen, I mean, he's trash. He's not iconic. He's a disaster.
He's a psycho. Call him a psycho.
Yes. So she was talking about the fact that he was claiming that he's taking hydroxychloroquine to ward off coronavirus, whatever, like self-administering it. First of all, we know that nigga's lying, for one, okay? Because either he would be dead or he's having it administered to him properly, but it's dangerous for him to be saying that out loud when other Americans could adopt it because he is a cult leader and many of his acolytes do whatever he says to the detriment of their own health or their own economic stability. But Nancy Pelosi's conversation with Anderson Cooper, where she brought it up, she said, as far as the president is concerned, he's our president, and I would rather he not be taking something that has not been approved by the scientists, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group. Morbidly obese, they say. So I think it's not a good idea. First of all, you sound like Trump when you say this, right? The whole idea of, shall we say, weight group, morbidly obese, so they say. Like, you're trying to pawn off your insult of Trump as something that other people are saying instead of something that you're saying. And you know what? Like, Nancy, like, knuck if you buck, okay? Like, I've had enough of the everyone yes-queening over the clap that she did to Trump, yes-queening over the ripping up the speech behind him. It's like all of these little Twitter moments, these GIF moments, deciding to get people to stand something that's dramatic in politics rather than actually coming out and saying something that's useful and helpful to people in this time. And now you're using this moment to attack Trump because you think that he's morbidly obese. I want to say that whatever you think about Trump, there are a million things to say about him that don't involve his weight, because what you're actually doing is attacking other people who are fat, you know, and it shows what you think of them. You know, it's so many people hopping online to defend her or saying, oh, this is funny. Or when you say that it's in poor taste for her to be saying this, you're accused of being sensitive. And I think it's just a common conversation that we have about people's bodies that is really inappropriate. People in your lives who are fat hear you saying these things and they don't feel good about them. You know, particularly like now in the coronavirus epidemic, right? You know, like, how many tweets do you see from people who, like, it seems like turning back to look at his wife level, the idea that you might gain weight from eating too much in this pandemic, right? It's like the way that people just talk about their bodies online, as if that is the possibly worst thing that could ever happen to them. It makes you sound cruel. And then laughing at Nancy Pelosi's joke is, I don't know, it's dumb. It's not funny. It's lazy.
It also just reminds me, by the way, of when I think of just one of the many reasons I particularly love Elizabeth Warren is the directness with which she would respond to Trump's idiocy. It wouldn't go to a place of quote unquote shade, which is what Nancy Pelosi, I think, was trying to execute. It's just, he's so abysmal. Why not just respond with absolute directness about what he said, about what he's doing, and not like do this like coy finger wag about who he is? It just, I don't see how, it reminds me of like a bad interpretation of the when they go low, we go high thing. Like, well, they're terrible, but I'm only going to imply something terrible. It's like, that's not what that means. You know, you can still be direct and knock him down the 1,000 pegs he deserves to be knocked down, but you have to find a direct and frankly professional sounding way of doing it.
Yeah, because when you make this reference, you're speaking for the headline. All of the headlines are going to mention Nancy Pelosi calls Trump morbidly obese, you know, like Nancy Pelosi rips up the speech, etc. Like, you're not going to get the headlines that says Nancy Pelosi says don't take this shit because it could kill you. Like, be to the point. Speak to what you need to be speaking about and don't try to be like white teenager on TikTok, like lip syncing to NeNe Leakes shade, you know? It's like she was a step away from going like, what is this, honey? You got a white refrigerator, Trump? Let's go buy you a home.
Also, Nancy Pelosi, please don't ever put me in a position where I have to, even in a roundabout way, defend Donald Trump. Like, that's what this is. And, you know, it's a conversation of like, and we were talking about this too, Ira, that I don't fully care that she insulted Trump. I would be fine. I would even invite that in a different situation. But call him a bitch.
Call him a bitch.
Call the beast the beast.
That's what he is. Call him a bitch.
Call the thing that it is. But more importantly, like, we have to maintain a certain standard about who and how we talk about bodies so that it's not hypocritical when I say, don't call Lizzo this or don't call Adele this. I also have to defend Trump. Like, it's such a fucked up paradox that you put me in when you open your mouth, Nancy Pelosi. Don't do this to me.
Thanks, Nancy.
She listens to this every week, by the way. Thank God she's going to heed this advice. I'm thrilled. I'm thinking of who my favorite Nancy is now that Nancy Pelosi has stepped down. It's Nancy Walker from Rhoda. Take that.
Mine's Sinatra.
Oh, sure. I would pick that for you.
I'm a bit of a day tripper, if you will.
Cute. Nice work.
Who's your favorite Nancy, Aida?
Nancy Drew. Easily. To keep the theme of detectives that we've had this whole episode for some reason, fine. Nancy Drew.
Nancy Drew. She do be in people's business.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I love that for her. I love
the
that
secret
for her.
Of the locket. She knows it.
Yeah. She nosy. Nancy Drew is nosy. Well, there's our episode. And next week, we'll have as a guest Nancy Spungen's ghost.
Good for us. She has some problems. We'll see how that goes.
Thanks again to David Diggs for joining us. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.